This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
What's up, what's up?
Hey, what's going on?
I guess Andrew's not joining us today because he's on his cross-country move still.
Yeah, his house didn't burn down.
Gosh. Yeah, so I guess that happened on Twitter after we recorded. Yeah, I guess his house caught on fire, he's moving out of. God, what a week for Andrew.
Maybe a little insurance scam before he leaves.
Yeah, I went from, I don't know, having fun joking about skating to like feeling incredibly bad for Andrew.
It sounded like he got his cast cut off, so.
Oh, did he?
He may be good now. Those young kids, they recover so quickly.
We talked about him coming through Memphis and I was like, hey, are you still coming this week? He's like, oh, I'm in Texas already.
Yeah, I saw the picture of him like in Arizona or something on Twitter. And I was like, oh, I guess he's not stopping in Memphis then.
Yeah, he said we could hang out. He explained why, but plus with, I think, the impending East Coast gas shortage, he was like, I just don't want to take any chances. I was like, I got
you. Yeah, sounds like a good one. Well, probably hang out with him at RailsConf next year or something.
Yeah, or 2023, 2024.
Yeah. It all blends together anymore. So,
yeah. Well, how are you?
I'm good. We are in limbo of the waiting for the construction loan to come through, fingers crossed. And we have had so much rain that, like, I posted pictures of us getting all the trees torn down like a month ago. And yesterday, finally, some company came out and like ground up all the branches and stuff. Then we're set for another 7 days of rain. At some point, we'll get the like approval to start building. We got approved by the city for the permit, which is good. Right. But you know, if it keeps raining, then that's not going to be great for like excavation and then pouring the foundation and stuff. So I'm like, we threw all the April showers in the middle of May yet, but it doesn't seem like that's over yet.
In Mississippi, where they have the casinos that we talked about in the last episode, they're all on water because that's how they get around the
law
of having casinos like on land. So you could
just have one of those
house in the same way where you have like a moat around it.
I saw a house that was like a two-story house, but it was a boat. You know, they would just dock and then go move around. And it was like this good sized house. Like it reminded me of the size of my last house, but as a boat. And it was just like a big rectangle with like sliding glass doors and like a patio out there. And I was like, that's pretty cool. We would just like head to Europe from our house for a little while.
Does it look like a house? like a colonial style house is floating on the river?
It was like a rectangular, like a modern, like contemporary shape and stuff. But if you know, like the California style of rectangular buildings and stuff, it reminded me of that. But yeah, it'd be nice to have like some old style house on a boat, just and then hide the boat away, like visually or something. So it just looks like it's floating away.
You could have like a big concrete barrier at like your residence. And when you like pull up to it, like the house comes up right to the steps. And it's just.
Yeah. I was saying earlier today in Slack that my next startup idea probably needs to be, instead of Beyond Meat making like fake burgers,
right,
we basically need to do the same thing for lumber because lumber is so expensive. We'll just do fake wood.
I think that exists. I think particle we'll board,
just,
there's.
Yeah. You know, we just need like stuff that's not wood based. We'll just like lab grow it. You know, it'll end up costing a crap load more than the lumber unit is. But, you know.
Every time I knock on my IKEA desk, I feel like I'm jinxing it because it's like I'm not really knocking on wood.
So when I moved to New York City, I think I had two of the IKEA bookshelves, the 2 squares by 4 squares. Oh my gosh. Yeah, but the like full, you know, bookshelf unit thing. Yeah. There is so much glue in that thing. It is so heavy to pick up. And like, unfortunately, I had to walk down the street because the parking was so bad. Yeah, imagine me carrying one of those by myself, resting it on my foot to like walk it down the street. It was awful. New York City was a hard move. So I should have done the thing that Andrew did with whatever fits in my car, because I have a Mini Cooper, so it would be basically nothing.
It's just like just a Mustang. Move
that instead. Yeah.
Well, once again, we get going. We actually have a guest today. So sorry to keep you waiting, Jason, but Jason Sweat's joining us. He's been with us before. You've probably seen him online talking about testing and disdain for service objects and all the things. So thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So what's new? What's good?
Oh man, work is getting really busy. Maybe I'll real quick introduce myself for anybody who's not familiar. So if you see my writings online, you might know me for writing about Rails testing. That's kind of what I've been doing for the last three and a half years. And then of course I host a podcast called Rails with Jason, and I've dabbled a tiny bit in YouTube videos and stuff like that, but I've discovered that's not really my forte. I'm mainly a blogger and podcast guy. But yeah, that's what I do for my online activities. But I also have a regular job. I work for a medical clinic, and I lead a small team of three developers, including myself. And so things are just getting busier and busier. Everything is kind of a function of how many doctors we hire. And my boss is wanting to grow the business as fast as possible. So when I started, we had two doctors. Now we have five doctors. Soon we're going to have seven doctors. And the development team went from just me, and now we have three, and soon we're probably going to have more. So yeah, getting super busy.
That's great. So we have all kinds of things we can talk about. I know before we were recording, we were talking about some testing stuff, but I did actually want to chat a little bit about, I kind of joked about your disdain for service objects, but I've noticed, I've read some things about you talking about that recently. And I would actually just kind of like to chat about that and get your two cents on it, because I kind of ebb and flow. Sometimes I'm like, yes, service objects are the way. And then sometimes I'm like, give me all the plain old Ruby objects. And then sometimes I'm like, just put it all in the controller. I think it's an interesting thing to chat about, and would love to maybe just start with maybe we'll define what a service object is and then go into kind of how you view the world in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, the definition part is kind of the first challenge, because different people use the term service object to refer to different things. For some people, the term service object is synonymous with plain old Ruby object. For some people, it's more synonymous with what you might call the command pattern, where you have some procedural code inside of an object. And then for some people, maybe it means something else. So that's part of the challenge in talking about it. But when I hear most people talking about it, I think they're talking about that kind of a procedural code inside of an object kind of a structure.
Yeah, I think that's a very good definition for that.
Do you guys use service objects? And if so, or even if not, what comes to mind for you when you just hear the term service object?
For me, it's almost kind of maybe narrow, but really it's just abstracting away multiple operations. You could say business logic, I guess, but typically for me, anytime I have a set of procedures or things I need to run, then something that encapsulates that to me is a service object.
Yeah. As I started thinking and writing about this more, I came to a realization. I tried to ask myself, why do I have such a distaste for service objects exactly? And I think it comes down to this, not to get super philosophical, but I think you can look at a web application in kind of two ways. You can look at it as a series of things that need to be carried out, or you can look at it as a bunch of objects that have properties and behavior. So you can look at it in an imperative sense or a declarative sense. And me, I have a strong preference for expressing things declarative. I don't know. Anyway, that's how I tend to lean. Although I think it's maybe not the most natural way to lean. When I was starting with programming, I certainly expressed things in a more imperative sense, because that just kind of seems natural. You know, if you use that example of explaining to a robot how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, the natural way to do it seems to be step one, get the jar of peanut butter. Step two, get the jar of jelly, et cetera, and list out imperative steps. Rather than having, it's maybe a little bit less natural to say peanut butter sandwich dot create or whatever it might be.
Well, I know, you know, DHH talks or has talked a lot about like the chaining of method calls and stuff being something he encourages and stuff. And I think that leads towards the like declarative style. An example that came to mind when you were talking about this was like, if you're doing payments, it feels natural to say like, charge this user, but then you can split that in two different ways. You can say like, we have a class that knows if you give it a user and you say, charge them $100, it knows how to do that and apply it to that person's credit card. Or you could go the other direction and say, here, I have a user, I want to charge them $100. And the user knows how to be charged. And it's kind of the two different ways of organizing that logic. You could either have something that you can interchangeably give the user and the credit card or whatever, and then you can have the user know about that concept. And it's, I think certain things I don't feel like fit certain types of things.
Like the challenging thing about examples with this is like any examples that somebody can come up with off the top of their head are like too simple to really make a compelling case in either direction. Your example with the users and payments and stuff, it's kind of six one way, half a dozen the other. You could do it as an imperative service object, or you could do it as a declarative object. And either way, it's kind of equally as good. There's no one way that's clearly better. And so what I've tried to do recently is try to think of those really complicated examples where it is clear one way. Unfortunately, those complicated examples are hard to come up with and hard to communicate with. But I wrote this blog post recently, which I'll just kind of summarize really concisely, which is I have this file that's a really weird format. It's like an aggregation of charges at the medical clinic. And it has a lot of things that need to go into it. And it could easily be imagined as like constructing this file in a series of steps. But instead of expressing it that way in the code, I created an object. It's called like a Zermed 893 file or something like that. And so that's what the object is called. And at the surface, it almost looks like a service object because I'm saying like Zermed file dot create or something like that. You know, I'm telling it to do something that's imperative because at the tip level of the pyramid, it has to be imperative. Your app has to do something at some point. You know, it can't just all be declarative. So the tip of the pyramid is always going to be imperative. But then underneath that, it's not a bunch of steps, it's a bunch of objects. The reason I prefer this is because I think declarative stuff is easier to understand because it's just kind of static. It's not moving. It's just a thing. You're describing a thing. And I think it's easier to understand a static thing than it is to understand a series of things that happen, because I'm just kind of thinking through some of this for the first time, but when you see a list of things that happen, you have to kind of keep track of the state of everything. Okay, step one happened, now everything's like this. Okay, step two, step three, this changed, so this is like this, blah, blah, blah. That's a little harder to keep track of, and so that's why I think I prefer the declarative style. But yeah, my perhaps non-clarity of that example that I gave is like an illustration of the fact that it's really hard to come up with examples for service objects versus OOP or whatever, because the simple examples are like too simple and the complex ones are often too hard to communicate.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think a lot of people look at this too in the idea of how am I going to test this code? And if you have to create a lot of state to set up and run a test, then it gets to be cumbersome. And so then sometimes the other approach of like, okay, we have this service object and we just toss in these two objects and call this method. And it doesn't require as much prep sometimes, then that can be easier to test or whatever, but it's not necessarily as intuitive to read or like use sometimes as well. So the complicated examples are the hardest to come up with, but they're like the only real way to like figure out which approach do you want to use in this case? You know, it's really hard to find good examples.
Yeah. Well, one challenge that I've had is that like, I never really come across cases in my own work where it's like, should I go service object or should I go just objects in this case? And I think the reason for that, again, goes back to the declarative versus imperative. I'm already thinking of everything as declarative, so it would never occur to me to conceive of a feature in imperative terms and therefore consider a service object for it. I want to address something else you said, Chris, regarding testing, because one argument I've heard in favor of service objects is that it makes testing easier. I don't buy that because things are easy or hard to test relative to, among other things, how tightly or loosely coupled they are with other parts of the system. In general, if something doesn't depend on other parts of the system, then it's easier to test because you don't have to do as much setup work to get that test set up. And of course, in the opposite case, if it's entangled with a bunch of other parts of the system, then that's going to be a very difficult test to write. And to me, whether something is imperative or declarative, service object or not service object, it's kind of orthogonal to whether it has tight coupling with the other parts of the system. So that's an argument that I don't really buy.
I kind of struggle with that one though, because most of the time when I'm writing service objects, I'm doing it to replace. So for me, like there's a couple of different scenarios, but the one that most often is like I'm replacing controller logic. You know, when I'm testing a controller, a lot of that's abstracted for me, but there is still like a whole nother like abstraction of I have to hit an endpoint with the right params and then test that all these things happen. We use interactors at Podia, but even if I had like just a Ruby object for testing that, I could just test, oh, this thing gets called, and then have like actual unit tests for that object. And so like in that context for me, it is a little bit easier to test, but I do buy into the argument of side by side, there's not much difference, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And it took me a long time to like arrive at my current coding style of composing things out of objects. So here's kind of my hypothesis as to why service objects are so popular. My perception, and this goes back to like when I first started with Rails, you have these slots that things slot into, like controllers, models, helpers, jobs, all this stuff. And so you'll have a piece of behavior and you'll say, oh, this is related to responding to a request. That's a controller thing. Or this has a bunch of complex business logic that will go in a model. And so you have these slots you can put things in and it feels pretty natural. That maybe works out good for the first few months. But then once things start getting really complicated, if you continue to follow that pattern of just putting things in the slots where they feel natural, you'll probably end up with really bloated models. Because for me in the past, when I first started with Rails, my app had say 12 database tables, I would have exactly 12 model files and no more. Because it didn't really occur to me that I could take some of that stuff from the model files and put it into other Ruby files inside of app models, and it doesn't have to inherit from Active Record. So I started to think about what is a model? Because maybe in the beginning, I thought of model as being synonymous with database model, but that doesn't have to be true. And that's not the way I think of it now. A model is just something that models a concept in my application. And neither does it have to be database related, nor does it have to be related to anything that actually exists in the real world. And so once I like switched that on, it like allowed me an inventiveness that I didn't have before. Like, for example, I came up with this idea putting together that weird formatted file with all the charges in it. I came up with this object called the charge slot. You know, all these OOP examples of like dog and cat or car and engine and stuff like that. And for me, it kind of gave me the idea that my models, I was supposed to take things from the real world and make those into abstractions in my program. But then I started realizing at one point, like think about some of the stuff in Rails, hash with indifferent access, for example, that's a totally made up idea. They didn't grab that from the real world, obviously. They just made up this idea of a hash that you could access keys with either symbols or strings, and they created this new object. So I've started doing that in my applications, and I just put all that inside of app models. And that was a really like hard thing for me to realize. And it took me like years to get to that point. And my suspicion is that a lot of Rails developers haven't made that realization that they can conceive of abstractions that way and just put them in app models, because they're models in just as valid of a way as the active record models. And they don't have to have this other, you know, I think they see, okay, controllers, helpers, and now I have this other stuff. I don't have a place to put it. And so maybe service objects are this place where I can put things, but I don't think you need that.
That's an interesting point too, because like, if you think about it, in Rails, active model is separate from active record, right? Those are two different abstractions. And like Chris has said many times, I'm kind of narrowing it down, but like two things Chris always says, like that would make Rails developers' lives easier. If they knew they could add other folders to the app directory, and if they would use non-active record models.
Yeah.
It is a game changer.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One of the things that's really tricky about error monitoring is that when you get an error, it could have come from anywhere. It could have come from a background job or a user doing some weird thing. They have JavaScript turned off. You never know. And so you might get these stack traces, but you might not know how to debug them. And that is really a pain in the butt. So Honeybadger has a really cool feature called Breadcrumbs. And you can integrate their client-side and server-side libraries so that you can track what was going on when an error occurred. So for example, you have a front end, it has a button to go sign up, your user clicks that and it makes a post request to your API, and your API has a failure response, and then your JavaScript has an error because, well, something went wrong on the back end. Well, what's really cool is that you're able to track all of that with Honeybadger and see the steps that actually happened in the browser and the server side. So you can go replicate those steps and try it yourself and actually replicate those errors and actually solve the bugs. And that is super cool, because if you're just trying to look at the stack trace and you don't know what happened that led to that, it's really tough. So Honeybadger can really save you a bunch of time. I think that is one of my favorite features that they offer. And, you know, like we've said before, they have check-in monitoring. So if you've got cron jobs or like regular scheduled background jobs or anything like that, you can have those check in with Honeybadger and make sure that they're running, so you can feel confident that, yes, your cron jobs actually are running. So that's it. I just wanted to give them a shout out. We love Honeybadger, and they've been a long, long time supporter of everyone in the Rails community, and they will continue to be. So check them out. They've got a generous free tier. There's really no reason not to use them. I just made, for an app that I'm doing, it supports subdomains and custom domains, and it will, you know, serve traffic differently for those, depending on if you're on like the main, you know, site and you're editing your subdomain or your custom domain app. So usually first thing you do is you go set up a class or a constraint for your route. So you say like, if it's www or help or support or whatever dot my domain, those are ours. And if it's a different one that the customer chose, we'll render their version of the app. Usually you need that same thing throughout your app as well. So you might need that in your controllers and say like, oh, is this running on our domain or is it, you know, the subdomain for the customer view? Like Podia is a good example of that. You go to podia.com and you want to see the Podia interface. But if you go to gorails.podia.com, then you want to see my actual storefront. Instead of putting that class in like the lib folder somewhere, I just put it in under app lib, and I can use that now easily and find it in my controllers and my routes anywhere. And it'll be auto-loaded by the Rails auto-loader and stuff. And it just makes it easy. And it's, you know, I didn't really have a good name for it, so I didn't have anything better than app lib to name that folder. But like in Hatchbox, I have all these scripts that we run to configure a server, and those are app scripts. And then I have app providers, which are like DigitalOcean and AWS and Vulture and so on. And it's really nice to be able to say like, okay, this app is going to have these core concepts that, you know, I kind of like to keep my app models mostly database related if I can. But at the beginning, when I don't really have these clear concepts. I won't go make folders. I'll put them in app models first. But one thing I did think of when you guys were talking was, I think maybe the first place I started to like really open my mind about this was Basecamp open source, the name of person gem. And that was like so obvious all of a sudden when I saw that. Normally what I ended up doing was like, I have a user and they have either like a full name field or a first and last name. And then I have helper methods that like either split the full name into first and last or combine first and last into the full name and so on. But that library actually has a very small thing you include in your model, and it adds the full name attribute. And then it will split it out into first and last, but then it basically wraps that in a class. So you can say user.name. You know, display name or something like that, and get like first name and the first character of their last name. And I realized like at that point, we could even wrap the individual sort of attributes of a user in another object, but then still make it really easy to grab the instance of that. So we can test this class that's like a name class, and it knows we have a first and last name, and we can combine it in all these different formats, and you can really easily write tests for that. But then you can build a little helper on your model that's like, hey, whenever someone asks for this, go instantiate that class, give it our name, and then you return that, and then you can call those methods on there. And I was like, this is pretty cool. And then that is actually how, or very similar at least, to how Action Text does their body. They use a serialize on the body as an action text content. So you end up dealing with that class instead of just the string out of the database when you access that. And I was like, this is really smart. You like intercept that and you now have this like object that's this concept of a action text content. And it knows how to be like text or HTML or toString. And you don't have to like write a method that wraps that or anything. Like Rails can kind of just convert it for you. And I thought those two were really good examples of like a different way to think about things if you haven't thought about it that way before. I really like that. It felt smooth.
This reminds me of a couple abstractions we've come up with in our app that maybe the me of 3 years ago wouldn't have come up with. So we have this need in the system to make it obvious when a patient's name is not unique. Because like if somebody's name is John Smith and a doctor pulls up that patient's chart, we need to alert them like, hey, this isn't the only patient named John Smith. Make sure this is the right John Smith. And we ended up creating a new object called patient name. We have a database table called patients, which has just the patient's first and last name separately. But then you can do things like, well, first of all, when you do any patient.name, that name will return an instance of the patient name object populated with that patient's first and last name. And then you can do things like patient.name.unique question mark, and it'll tell you if that patient's name is unique. You do patient.name patients with this name. And then there's some caching related stuff that's just on the patient name. And that made it fairly tidy to be able to put all those name related concerns in the patient name object, rather than have it sprinkled. You know, there's that term shotgun surgery where like if you need to change something, if you need to go change like 12 different files all over the place, then that's bad. But if it can all be in one place or at least a small number of places, then that's a little better. So it's nice to be able to package that stuff all up in this patient name object. And then one more example I'll give is phone numbers. We do a lot of phone number stuff. And so this actually started out as a Poro, a plain old Ruby object called phone number, but it eventually kind of graduated to an active record class because we, or at least I decided it would be smarter to have a phone numbers table where we keep just every single phone number in the system in this phone number table rather than having them scattered in different tables. But this object has methods like with country code, if we want to have the country code added to the phone number, digit count, all kinds of stuff. And that's kind of a bad example because it does inherit from Active Record now, but it started its life as just a Poro and it was still useful back then because you could do all this stuff with phone numbers. And again, me from a few years ago, I might have not realized that I could just create an object called phone number, put it in app models because it is a model, and then use that to do whatever phone number stuff I needed to do, rather than having, like, I don't know, phone number methods on a patient or something like that.
Yeah, or like littering your helpers with random little things like that where you're like, it didn't fit in the model, and we mostly use it for like rendering out in the views, so maybe we'll put it there. And it's like, it's really convenient to actually have just a phone number concept. And it's like, okay, we know how to display ourselves with or without the like plus prefix and whatever. And it's like, now it's a really concise thing, and you can make that into a gem and just share that between all your apps. And like, name of person was a good example of like, they launched it or open sourced it, and they were like, it's considered done. We're not really planning on ever like improving this or changing it. There's not really a need. And same thing would go with your phone numbers. Format's not likely to change very often. You know, you could just easily reuse that everywhere, and it's its own little thing.
If you look at like the source of Ruby and Rails, or just like pay close attention to the names of things in Rails, they do this kind of stuff a lot too. I don't know, when you have a form, the part that you see is a form for or form with or whatever. But then what's under the hood is an object. It's like an instance of Form Builder or something like that. And once you start looking for that stuff, you start noticing it everywhere. And it's like, oh, everything is made out of objects. But most people, I think they haven't like taken that idea and like brought it into their own application code. And again, that's something that I've only relatively recently started doing myself. But when you do, it's like such a huge perspective shift.
It really is. You end up with this idea that you don't have to have something concrete like a database table to make a class. You can have a concept of a phone number, or, you know, an action text content is a thing, and a route is a thing. And there's all kinds of those, especially when you get into like Form Builder, there's like a text field and, you know, all the different types, and they're all similar, but they, you know, more or less they have the same interface, but they know like if we're doing a select, that's going to require different things like an array instead of just a string value like a text field would display, and so on. And then that makes them very concise, which is really handy. And you can like reason about them individually nicely.
And I think one thing that's maybe an obstacle to learning about this stuff is that Rails itself obscures a lot. When you create a new Rails application and you generate a lot of scaffolds, there's a lot of stuff that's there that's just boilerplate or whatever you want to call it. And so like, if your application is like 90% auto-generated scaffold stuff and 10% your own custom code, first of all, that's great because Rails is doing so much work for us. But the downside of that is it obscures the unique parts of your application code that's the stuff you wrote. So what I would maybe recommend to somebody, if somebody's hearing this and saying, okay, this sounds like a good idea, but I don't really know how to like get into that mindset or whatever, I might suggest writing some pure Ruby. I did this as an example for a totally different reason, but like I created this small little, it was just one Ruby file where it would take a book and it would like count all the instances of the words in the book. And so, you know, it would take like, I went to like the Gutenberg project where you can get the text of books, and I plugged in Alice in Wonderland, and it's like, okay, the word "and" appears 47,266 times, blah, blah, blah. And it would just list all the counts. And this was for a talk about refactoring legacy code. This was actually kind of hard to do. I like wrote the code as terrible as I possibly could, so that I would have something really bad to refactor into something good. But I might encourage somebody to do some kind of exercise like that. Don't worry about making the code good at first. And then once you have this big chunk of, you know, maybe you have 100 lines of procedural code, see if you can refactor that into some objects. And I think it's probably only by doing exercises like that, where maybe not only by doing that, but if you do an exercise like that where you're saying, okay, I'm going to shove Rails aside for a little bit and only think about Ruby by itself, then you can learn a lot. And then when you come back to Rails, you'll be a lot better equipped to recognize opportunities for structuring things in objects.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I've done a bunch of those projects in the past to learn Python or Ruby or whatever. One of my favorites was go build yourself a IRC client and just use Ruby and set up your TCP connections and respond to the messages as they come through. And you very quickly start to realize how to organize things, or that you don't know how to do it and that you need to learn. And I think that was like,
yeah, there's really no place to hide
for me. Yeah.
When you're working with Rails, it's kind of like your code is mixed with the Rails code. And so it like can look okay, even if you don't really know what you're doing that much. But if you're doing just Ruby, there's no place to hide. Either your code is going to be good or bad, and it's going to be painfully obvious if it's bad.
So I just looked at the time and we're like, we're getting close. So I wanted to, I think we all kind of wanted to talk about testing today, but we maybe don't have the time left that we wanted to. But I did want to talk about your new book on testing and maybe give you an opportunity to kind of share some information with us about that.
Yeah. So like I said at the top of the show, I've been writing about Rails testing for about the last 3.5 years. And I wrote a book that I released in early 2019 called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. But then as I learned more about testing myself and got better at teaching testing, I realized that could actually be presented a lot better. And so I decided to write a bigger, meatier book that's not just for beginners, although it's kind of targeted at beginners and definitely beginner friendly. This one's called The Complete Guide to Rails Testing. And what's in it is kind of a mix of testing principles and testing tools. So regarding the tools, it covers like FactoryBot, RSpec syntax, Capybara. Basically, if you use RSpec, like all of those tools that you would expect to be in there, they are. And like part of my motivation was like being frustrated with the, what is it? Those RSpec docs that you, that there's that one website that you always, the Relish website.
Yeah.
Frankly, I'm a little frustrated sometimes at the documentation on the Relish website. And so I took some of the stuff that was maybe a little lacking there and tried to do it better in the book. So that's like the tool stuff. And then the other part of it is the principle stuff. For example, what level of test coverage to shoot for, how to make testing a habitual part of your workflow and stuff like that.
That's great. I think that's going to be a really good resource. My first foray into testing was with RSpec at my like first Rails job. I guess, you know, with the knowledge that I have now, almost 10 years later, I forget how much I take for granted, how hard it is to kind of learn that. It's a whole new world. RSpec syntax aside, it's, you know, what do you test? How do you set it up? Especially when you are coming into someone else's code base as a junior or even just as another developer changing jobs. It's, I don't know. So I think that's like a really good resource and I'm excited to point people that way.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, that reminds me of when I was learning Python, I was trying to teach myself Python. And then at some point I was like, I need to like learn how to test code. And I could not, because I was on my own, like I could not figure out how do you write tests that aren't just the exact same code as I wrote? It was right. Like, you know, like I couldn't wrap my head around, I know my code needs to do this thing. How is my test supposed to be any different than the code I already have to write? And I remember a really hard hurdle to get over because I didn't have anybody or any books or anything like on testing. And that I remember just being like, what the heck? What, like, what is testing? Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's exactly why I chose this topic. It's really hard for a lot of people to get started with, including me when I started with, almost as hard as learning programming itself.
It's especially dangerous isn't the right word, but it's especially challenging, like Chris was talking about. Like, you learn programming. For me, like, I learned programming first, and I learned how to write Rails, and that's what I wanted to do is write the best Ruby and Rails code I could and learn Active Record and learn all the things. And then it was like, okay, you got to test. And I'm like I just didn't, you don't know what to do. You just lock up.
Right. Same experience I had.
Well, that's exciting. And by the time you're listening to this, that is available and we will have a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah. And I'm just going to decide right now that we can have a remote Ruby discount code. If you use the discount code remote Ruby, you'll get a discount.
Respect.
Yay. Yeah, I was just going to say, is anything else you want to mention before we're done?
I'll mention one super quick thing. If the testing stuff sounds interesting to you and you just want like a sample of what I'm teaching, you can go to railstestingguide.com and get a little guide that I put together that helps you get started.
Very cool. Well, I think I'm going to preemptively extend another invitation for you to come back because we've talked testing before. I mean, many times, but I have lots on my mind recently about testing. I've been jumping back into the mini test fixtures world. And then also, you know, at work, still very invested in FactoryBot and RSpec and all the things. And I don't know, pros and cons to all. So we'd love just to chat more about it in the future. So
yeah, I would love that.
Cool. Well, where can the good folks listening find you?
Well, again, there's the old railstestingguide.com. But then the other place that's kind of the hub for everything I do is codewithjason.com.
You really took over the Jason branding in the Ruby community. So
I apologize.
It's all right. I'm now the other Jason when I meet people. So it's fine.
That's yeah, you cool can't though. Have codewithjason.com. It would have to be codewithjasoncharns.com. And I feel bad now.
Nobody needs to know who I am. It's great. So cool. Well, thanks again for joining us and we'll talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
See ya.